Welcome to the Horses Equine Innovators Podcast, sponsored by Zoetis. I'm your host, Stephanie Church, Editor-in-Chief at The Horse. Every day, researchers at universities and other institutions around the world are investigating new ways to care for and understand our horses in the horse industry. In this podcast series, we talk to those innovators to learn more about their work. First today, a message from our sponsor. Core EQ Innovator from Zoetis is the first and only vaccine to protect against all five potentially fatal core equine diseases in a single injection. Rabies, tetanus, West Nile virus, plus Eastern and Western encephalomyelitis. Talk to your veterinarian today to schedule your horse's vaccination with Core EQ Innovator. And now for today's conversation. As horse owners, we generally don't interact with equine pathologists. Typically, our veterinarians deliver pathology findings on nasal swabs, biopsies, and sometimes, sadly, necropsies. But equine pathologists do so much more than examine tissue samples and cadavers. They can identify and interrupt disease outbreaks, help vets better identify and treat conditions like wobbler syndrome, and more. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Jennifer Janes of the University of Kentucky's Department of Veterinary Science, who is based at the school's Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory here in Lexington. Welcome, Dr. Janes. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'm very excited to be here and chat with you today.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background first. I'm curious about how you ended up as an equine pathologist.
For sure. It's definitely probably not one of the traditional routes you hear of as far as equine health and veterinary medicine and things like that, but it is a path nonetheless. So a little bit about me. I'm originally from Illinois. I'm a Midwestern girl. Again, grew up with a love of horses and things like that. I did my undergrad work at Vanderbilt, where of all things, I was a piano major, kind of spiced things up a little bit. And then after that, I went to the University of Tennessee, College of Veterinary Medicine, and loved my time there. Had a strong equine interest. I was working in, you know, veterinary practices over the summer with an equine focus, hunter jumper farms, things like that, with the original intention of being an equine ambulatory practitioner. And while I was at vet school, I also started to kind of get the interest in pathology, which is one of the core classes that you have to take in your rotations. And for me, what I really liked about pathology was it's kind of connecting the dots of why something's occurring, why are we seeing the lesions that we're seeing, and how we can diagnose it. And so I kind of liked that progression of flow as well. And so I was like, well, I'll just kind of keep that in the back of my mind. I think one of the most amazing things about veterinary medicine is you can really do what you want with it over your career, whether you're in practice or One Health and things like that. So it allows a lot of opportunities. But staying with the equine interest, after I graduated from the University of Tennessee, I went up to Wisconsin Equine Clinic and Hospital. It's a large referral equine clinic outside of Milwaukee in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Took me a little while to be able to learn to say Oconomowoc correctly. And I did a rotating equine internship. So we had about 15 veterinarians at the time, a large practice area, was able to enjoy a lot of time on the road and working with different, we actually had an EHV1 outbreak when I was up there that happened in the middle of winter, and Wisconsin winters can be fierce. But while I was there, I was also kind of developing an interest in musculoskeletal and still really wanting to kind of bring pathology in. And so when I was kind of looking at other opportunities, I came across at the University of Kentucky, back at the time, they had an anatomic pathology residency program, as well as an opportunity to complete a PhD at the Gluck Equine Research Center. So I reached out and applied for the program and was accepted into the program. And it really kind of allowed me to kind of blend everything together, my equine interests, pathology interests, and then my PhD ended up focusing on wobbler syndrome in horses. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of the full circle of everything. And to be able to do it in central Kentucky, where the equine population education is, you know, such a core of what we do here. Obviously, there's other important veterinary species. You know, we have big beef cattle industry, poultry industry, but, you know, the horse is quite important. And so I was able to complete my program, and then I joined the faculty here at the University of Kentucky Veterinary Diagnostic Lab in 2015, and I've been here ever since. And so largely my day is spent as a diagnostic anatomic pathologist, which I think we'll talk a little bit more later. But the other thing that I really like about my position and just the nature of the area that we're in, because of the concentration of the veterinarians and the Gluck Equine Research Center, there are a variety of collaborative research opportunities that we can address various aspects of equine health. And overall, my interests have continued both in equine musculoskeletal disease as well as neurologic disease. So I guess that's kind of the snapshot, the quick cliff notes of how I got here.
Thank you. That's really interesting. What an interesting circuitous path you've taken.
Right.
I'm really interested in seeing, I mean, so you've been there for 6 years, and I'm interested to see the different types of things that you've been working on during that time at the diagnostic lab. So could you explain to our listeners the importance of pathology to equine health, please?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, with pathology and stuff, a lot of times we think about the shows like CSI and the medical examiners, and, you know, there's this black light and techno music and you get a diagnosis in, you know, like 5 seconds. The reality of the situation is a little different, takes a little bit longer, but the focus is the same. So, like you said earlier, what we're able to do, whether we're looking at biopsies, so if your veterinarian takes a lump or bump off your horse and, you know, submits it to be examined, we're the ones that take a look at it to say like, oh, this is inflammatory, or maybe there's some bacteria, so they can do appropriate treatment, or, you know, this is neoplastic, this is some type of cancer, you need to cut it off, things like that. So that's definitely a part of what we do. And what that allows us to do is aid the veterinarian in a diagnosis for better treatment or management of a particular condition. So either whether we're doing that from the biopsy standpoint, or if a horse is euthanized or dies for some reason that it's either unknown or, you know, they want further clarification, then we can do what we call a postmortem examination, where they submit the animal after the animal has died, and then we can open and look at all of the tissues, and, you know, various gastrointestinal diseases. Obviously, colic is a big thing in horses. You know, if we're looking for infectious or inflammatory, that can be important to take back to the farm as that, is this an isolated thing, or is this, you know, potentially an infectious process that we need to worry about other horses on the farm? Other important processes that we can contribute to are things like potential toxicants. So monensin, as we know, is toxic to horses. It's a feed additive that is great for cattle, but if we have improperly mixed horse feed that has monensin in it, it's incredibly toxic to horses. And so there are certain lesions that we can see. And also, we're very lucky here that we have a veterinary toxicologist, so we can work with our toxicologist, Dr. Romano, to not only say, I see these lesions on histo, can we work up this differential? So there's a variety of ways that we can contribute to helping the submitting veterinarian or practitioners, you know, help to at least achieve a diagnosis or rule things out to work for either individual equine health or more of a herd health situation.
Oh, that's really interesting. Thank you. I hadn't even thought about the toxicology side, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you guys have your hands in a whole lot of different things. Probably very literally too.
I'm not going to disagree with you.
I'd like to give the listeners an idea of the veterinary diagnostic lab size, caseload, and function. I live just a few miles away, and I'm always curious about what's going on inside anytime I drive by that building. So what's a typical day for you like there?
Perfect. Absolutely. Kind of give some framework to everything. So first, I can actually just give a little description of the lab, because, you know, depending on where you are, you may or may not have a diagnostic lab that's in close proximity to you. So a lot of times people are sending samples away. But we're very lucky. We're actually one of two state diagnostic labs in the state of Kentucky. Obviously, we're in Lexington and associated with UK. Our sister lab is actually the Breathitt lab that's associated with Murray State out in Western Kentucky. And one of the exciting things, at least for us here at UKBDL, is that in 2011, we completed a almost $30 million expansion and renovation that basically resulted in doubling the size of the lab. And it really allows us to do our job that much better and support the constituents and the stakeholders and veterinarians in the area. It resulted in a larger necropsy suite, additional lab space, because it's not just pathology isn't the only section within a diagnostic lab, as you were talking about earlier, submitting swabs. So we have other ancillary sections. So it's been really nice to have that space because it really helps us accommodate our caseload. So as I mentioned, diagnostic labs are actually made up of multiple sections that can help with different disease testing results and things like that. Pathology being one of them, but we kind of talked about we're lucky that we have a veterinary toxicologist. A lot of labs don't have a boarded veterinary toxicologist, so we are lucky in that regard. We have a microbiology section that focuses on different bacteriology, virology testing, molecular biology, serology and epidemiology. And so these are different sections that also I'll use when I'm working up my various necropsy cases, when I need to order different ancillary testing to help achieve a diagnosis. So if I need to send some tissues for culture or tissues for PCR to test for like EPM or something like that. So it's really nice to have all of that under one roof. So, and given the kind of size of the equine population here, as well as actually poultry, I think one of the fun facts is like the number one agricultural animal in Kentucky as far as numbers is actually poultry, and then horses.
I didn't realize that. I had no idea.
So obviously the economic impact and everything with horses is huge and quite substantial. Mm-hmm. And most of our poultry are kind of in Western Kentucky. But on average, we receive close to 300,000 test submissions per year to the lab. And so, and that's not just pathology, it's across all of those sections. So we stay pretty busy as far as that. When we're looking particularly at the pathology caseload, when we look at our necropsies and our biopsies, so we typically receive around 3,000 necropsies per year and 3,000 biopsies per year. So that's 6,000 cases that we divide over. Currently, we have 7 pathologists, so a little under 1,000 cases per year for each of us to work through. And if we look at our species breakdown for necropsies, it's no surprise that equine, we're about a little over 50% equine. And a lot of that speaks to the industry in the area, both the thoroughbred industry, but we also have a large number of warm bloods here, saddlebreds, mm-hmm. things like that. And what that caseload looks like is it's everything from aborted fetuses, regardless of where they are in gestation, because it's important to achieve a diagnosis of the cause of abortion or rule things out like herpes and things like that, mm-hmm. All the way up to geriatric horses. So, and we receive horses for a variety of reasons, like I said, either diagnosis of disease or if there's insurance policies, things like that. So, but we're a little over 50%. After that, about 35% of our caseload is food animal. And that's because Kentucky actually has the largest beef cattle population east of the Mississippi. There's a little over 1 million beef cattle here.
Wow.
So that comprises that. So, but then looking at biopsy, we're kind of flipped to more companion animal is the majority of our caseload. We do get equine submissions for biopsies, both within the area. And we also get a number of equine biopsy submissions from out of state, from equine clinics that are not located in Kentucky. And I think a lot of that is just to do with the concentration of horses that we see. So, you know, we have veterinary clinics, you know, from New York, Illinois, Florida, that will send us cases as well. So that, and then as far as kind of how my day typically works, if we're talking just the pathologist, so if there's a necropsy submission, the animal will be brought to the laboratory, and we have a session form and history form for people to fill out so that we can have as much information as possible. And this is most often done by the veterinarian. And so that will be brought to the lab, and then we will do our postmortem examination. We have a fabulous group of technicians that help us in this process. If you can just imagine the logistics of working with these large animals. And so based on the history and my findings, my gross findings from the floor of just looking at the body, you know, typically if there's a prelim diagnosis, we'll go ahead and send that out same day. The owner always gets some type of report that day to either say that we've received and the testing is underway, or that, you know, this is what I saw on gross. And then from there, we take kind of sets of tissues. And then, like I said earlier, if I need to order something for culture or things like that, I can go ahead and order that and go from there. And then obviously we take a set of tissues that we put in formalin. And these are the tissues that we look under the microscope, that are processed to look under the microscope, and what we call the histologic examination. So once I get those back and the ancillary testing, then basically this results in a report that has my gross findings, my microscopic findings, any ancillary testing, and then a diagnosis, and then a comment if possible. And I think one of the great things about our situation is that we have such a great relationship with the practitioners within the area. So, you know, if I have a question or if they have an additional history while we're working on the case, it's very much an open door policy of talking back and forth, because obviously we want to achieve the best diagnosis we can for the horse, so or whatever species we get. But that's kind of the kind of step by step of working through a particular necropsy case. And then obviously with the biopsy case, those tissues come in fixed already, typically, and so we'll just look at those, and those will have a more rapid turnaround time to get back to the practitioner. So
okay, it sounds like no day is exactly the same.
Exactly, which is what I like.
That's good. That's good. And I think the listeners just need to know how many veterinarians are around here. There's so many equine veterinarians. It's a giant community. Everybody knows everybody. Yes. And it's great to hear that you guys are working together across the different types of veterinary professions too.
Absolutely. It's one of the things I enjoy most about this area, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. So, many of us remember seeing pathology samples in jars back in biology class, things like fetal pigs, bovine eyes, et cetera, et cetera. Could you tell us a little bit about your libraries that you have and what they make possible with research?
Absolutely. So one of the benefits of our area and being here in Central Kentucky is the high caseload. And so that allows us to develop these extensive archives of tissues. And typically when I say this, I mean the tissues that we have processed for microscopic exam. So we keep those in what we call paraffin embedded blocks. And so we have, you know, decades of archive tissues from cases over the years. And so, you know, if you're talking about something like, you know, MRLS or things like that, you know, we have the tissues from unfortunately MRLS that we hope never happens again, but also other processes. So things like Nicardiaform placentitis, a type of bacterial placentitis that we see. And so what that allows us to do is kind of look at these diseases over time. So if we start to see kind of a change, or you know, we can go back and look at the archive tissues and be like, is this potential pathogen presenting differently? Or, you know, is there maybe another pathogen there previously that we didn't discover until more recently? And so we can go back and be like, oh, this was actually here 5, 6, 7 years ago, and now we have the diagnostic methods to test for it. So it's a really great source of material, not only from a diagnostic standpoint, but from various collaborative research standpoints to look at different disease processes. And then also just to have the sheer numbers allows for more robust, like, retrospective analyses of different diseases, because, you know, we have on the thousands to tens of thousands of cases within our archives.
So for the listener who might not be familiar with the MRLS, that was male reproductive loss syndrome. I believe it was 2001.
I think so, is when yeah. It, luckily before my time.
Yes. Well, it wasn't before my time. I remember we were reporting on it. And I mean, even in that situation, there was, I can remember the researchers working with the clinicians who were treating the horses or finding the aborted foals and things like that, or finding the losses. Could you maybe in a nutshell explain what male reproductive loss syndrome was and kind of what that ended up being, so that the person who wasn't around then maybe could learn a little?
Yeah, so it was basically an unfortunate time where there was just this massive both kind of early fetal loss and late fetal loss that basically resulted in just a massive hit to the industry from the number of foals that were lost in that crop, and just had, you know, everybody scratching their heads. And so it was a situation where the practitioners and the researchers, and then obviously all of these cases were being submitted to the diagnostic lab for a postmortem exam to try and, you know, rule things out. And so through that whole collaboration and that time, they were able to isolate some particular bacteria and, you know, potentially the role of the caterpillar and things like that, and be able to kind of bring it all together. So it was a very scary time, because when you have a loss that is that massive, and just trying to figure out, you know, what are we ruling in, what are we ruling out? You know, I know at the lab from the pathologist before me, you know, it was talking about getting, you know, 30, 35, 50 cases per day just related to that mm-hmm. loss. And so just trying to work through that and have the resources. So it was definitely one of those where it took everybody involved to get it figured out.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately ended up being what the accidental consumption of Eastern tent caterpillars. And it was like the little hairs that are on the caterpillars.
Oh, yeah. Allow for
the next something. Okay. So they did something to the GI tract of the mare, right? And then ended up going into the bloodstream. Okay. Yeah. Something like that. Okay. this is the journalist perspective versus the pathologist perspective here. That was an interesting, almost like a CSI type thing, mm-hmm. Back in 2001, of everybody just trying to step in. And if there was something that they could stop, if there's some exposure that they could stop, okay, well, is it the caterpillars? Then we need to keep the mares off the field. Yeah. I think there was a cherry tree. Someone thought it might have been cherry trees at one point. So it was just basically a moving target. So thankfully we've not seen any more of that except in little spurts here and there, right?
Yeah, we just see it sporadically, but nothing to the level of what was seen back in the early 2000s, which is good.
Thankfully, yes, indeed. So have you had any discoveries in your day-to-day activities that you found surprising or fascinating?
For sure. I think, you know, like I said before, you know, since we do see such a high equine caseload, you know, you definitely get used to different disease processes and even kind of like the seasonality of things. So, you know, more in kind of the spring, summer, you know, we see more rhodococcus, you know, and then, you know, kind of move into like Potomac horse fever, Lawsonia is kind of over, you know, winter a little bit. And so you do get used to this, you know, seasonality. It's almost like I don't have to look at the calendar. I can just be like, oh, we're seeing these diseases now. So you kind of get used to the routine of how these diseases present. But sometimes I think the extent and severity, so for some of the rhodococcus cases, you know, obviously it can cause this devastating pneumonia in foals, but it can also cause lesions outside of the respiratory system. So we can get these huge masses, pyogranulomas in the abdomen that's affecting the lymph nodes. And I think just the severity and extent that these can go to, or sometimes they can go up to the spine and cause what we call an osteomyelitis, but basically a bacterial inflammatory infection within the bone itself. So these foals, you also have a subset that will present neurologic because they'll actually have an osteomyelitis within their spinal column. I think some of the developmental malformations can be interesting. I've had definitely a couple of kind of funky head sinus things that have presented. And so you just kind of, you're like, well, the body is a very interesting thing for sure. So I think the variation kind of, you know, when you think you've seen it all, then, you know, obviously pathogens and disease processes, you know, evolve, adapt, and things like that. And so, you know, you can start to see a variation on a theme for sure.
No, that's really interesting. So is it the time of horse fever season right now, or?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. How has our year been so far for that?
So far, I think we've been pretty quiet, which is good because that means they're treating them in the field.
That's good.
So,
yeah.
So it's always good when we don't see them. So, and that's how we prefer it.
Yes. Yes, so, indeed.
But yeah, indeed. At least as far as the post-mortem floor. Yeah.
And what's a 30,000 foot view on what Potomac horse fever is for the person who might not be familiar with that? I know it has a complicated life cycle. We don't have to get into it too deep, but just so they know what we're talking about.
Right. So Potomac horse fever, it's caused by an organism that we call Neo-Rickettsia rhistosi. Originally, it was kind of a sporadic disease, but you know, we are starting to see it in various locations within like the U.S. and Canada, and we typically see it in late spring, early fall. And so these horses will present with anything from fever to diarrhea, laminitis, colic. And so definitely, you know, supportive care is really important. So, you know, definitely it's on your list for colitis and laminitis. Mortality rates can vary anywhere from like 10 to 30%, things like that. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that it can result in abortion. So we have had a few cases, and I believe it's typically within 4 to 5 months of when they were, the mares were sick. And so I have had a couple of cases actually where in the history, the practitioners will say that, you know, the mare was treated for Potomac horse fever a few months ago. And we actually have a PCR test that we can run for the fetus for Potomac horse fever. And so it is definitely not a large cause for our equine abortions, but you know, I've definitely over the years I've had a couple of cases, so it's definitely important where that information and communication with the practitioner is important, because I think we definitely always think about the mare, which is, or you know, or the adult horse that's affected, which is important, but definitely in our mares, it's something to keep in mind. And like I said, it's a very small portion, but again, it's the ability to give an answer and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah.
And it's important to say that, you know, because I'm a horse fever, equine herpes virus, any of these diseases could have like an entire podcast devoted just to them, because they're just so complex and interesting. So let's talk about a syndrome that you have worked with called Wobbler syndrome. We've reported on some of your past research on this interesting condition. What is it, and in what horses do you see it most?
Perfect. So wobblers in general, if I'm talking with people, and I hope that people do not have an experience with wobblers, but unfortunately it is one of the more common neurologic musculoskeletal diseases that we see. So I think that the thing that to keep in mind about wobblers is basically there is some malformation or change in the cervical vertebrae, the neck vertebrae themselves, that result in a narrowing of that spinal canal, and the spinal cord gets compressed. So while these horses present with neurologic deficits due to that spinal cord compression, the underlying problem is actually a musculoskeletal problem. It's those malformations, those changes within the vertebrae themselves. And so we've kind of gotten to the point of thinking of it in two groups. So we have kind of our younger horses, development age, as far as, you know, we think of like the 2 to 3 to 4 year olds, as far as thoroughbreds, warm bloods, more 5 to 6 years of age. And that's because, as far as this developmental aspect, the growth plates in the neck actually don't close until 4 to 6 years of age in horses, depending on the breed. So we still have this kind of development and maturation of the vertebrae themselves. And so that's kind of our younger group that we see it in. And then now we're starting to see it in our older group of horses, older to middle-aged horses that have significant osteoarthritis of a particular joint in the neck. It's called the articular process joint. And it's a synovial joint, just like your knee joint and things like that. So a lot of times you'll hear of treatments to inject those articular process joints. So they can have significant osteoarthritis that actually also can result in compression of the cords. So we kind of have these two populations of horses. As far as more commonly affected breeds, there's been several multi-center studies looking at, you know, hospital submissions and things like that. And thoroughbreds are commonly reported, warm bloods, quarter horses, walking horses. Any breed can be affected, but those are the ones that we tend to see more commonly. And one of the other important things about wobblers is the gender ratio. So we see it much more common in males versus females. We do see it in fillies, just not as common as stallions or geldings. And when you look in the literature, that gender ratio is very well documented, anywhere from like 3-1 up to 11-1 of males versus females. And the interesting thing about the fillies that are affected is typically they tend to be kind of larger in size than their age match pasture mates. And that's related to some of the growth and aspects that we think, you know, results in this kind of imbalance in the bone maturation as they're growing so quickly. And so the interesting thing was we actually plotted age of admission, looking through Root and Riddle's case population a few years ago. We looked over a span of 10 years and we saw those two peaks. One was around like 6 to 12 months of age, and then another was around, you know, 24, 36 months of age. And it's interesting because those correspond to the two major growth periods within the horse, so around 6 months of age, and then the second around puberty. And so again, kind of speaking to the multifactorial nature of this disease, there's also the role of copper and zinc, which are trace minerals important for collagen and things like that. This longstanding question about, is there a genetic contribution? And so it's definitely a very complex disease, and, you know, typically we'll say multifactorial. And so, you know, so as far as the different treatment options, you know, it really has to be on a case by case basis. And I definitely leave that to my practitioner colleagues.
Mm-hmm. So can you kind of describe when you're working up a wobbler case or you are studying a wobbler case, how does that information come to you? Do you receive an MRI? Do you get clinical information from the veterinarian? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I think one of the exciting things about wobblers, I guess if you can say it, there's something exciting about it, is that recently we've had great advances in diagnostic imaging for horses. You know, obviously the size of the horse can make some of those imaging modalities that we're used to either in our small animals or on the human side, like CT and MRI. It's great in the small animal and human world, but the size of the horse, you know, it's a little different. So, you know, 5-6 years ago when we were doing our wobblers research, we were doing MRIs on these horses, I'll bet post-mortem, because the size, we couldn't do clinical MRIs, but that helped us kind of understand the pathology and the lesions that we were seeing in the vertebral column, because we could now look at the neck in multiple planes, whereas like with radiography, you're just looking from like the lateral aspect mainly. And so that was really great. But then it's like, well, we still can't do an MRI of the neck. We can do MRI of the limbs and horses, but now large bore CT units, which are kind of popping up at our veterinary schools, referral and tertiary clinics. These large bore clinical CT units, you can actually do a CT myelogram of a horse. And so a myelogram is one of those important imaging modalities to help clinically diagnose these diseases by seeing where the spinal cord compression is. And so the fact that we now have a CT where we can look at the neck in multiple planes, and so that really helps us to give an even better picture of what might be causing the compression or the malformation. And so, you know, for me as a pathologist, having as much imaging information prior is important, because it helps direct how I'm going to do my postmortem exam to make sure that we maximize identifying the lesions and things like that. So to me, having that information is incredibly beneficial from the practitioner, whether they shot radiographs, or if they did a myelogram, or if they did a CT myelogram, whatever information they were able to gather, their neurologic exam definitely helps me, you know, with my exam. And the better that we can identify and describe the different pathologies, helps to have us a better understanding of the disease itself. So it's definitely a nice way to work back and forth.
Mm-hmm. So then the veterinarian essentially has more information in their mind on when they have additional cases come in. And then do you take this information and store it for future research? Do you have any current studies that are happening with that information?
It's nice because, you know, because we have our archived reports and things like that. So then we can start to look at, are there, you know, certain locations that are more commonly affected and potential breeds. You know, I think we're starting to look at the caudal neck more and more. If you think that's like the area, it's almost like I described, kind of like the fulcrum, if you think as the horse is grazing or moving its head up and down. And so, you know, seeing more significant cervical osteoarthritis back in the caudal neck. And so that's where kind of, you know, being able to more, describe these different lesions and the context of age and sigmoment becomes important for, you know, understanding the syndrome and, you know, what treatment makes sense or doesn't make sense and things like that. And so I think just continuing to work with the synergy of the imaging modalities and then the postmortem exam to provide more information is where we are.
Okay, thank you. As an equine innovator, how do you foresee equine pathology changing and or shaping the future of horse health?
So I think, as I've kind of said before, and kind of how diagnostic pathologists fit within the entire scheme of veterinary medicine is, you know, continuing to be that kind of part of the pie as far as, you know, whether helping to achieve a diagnosis or, you know, looking at a particular disease entity more thoroughly to say, you know, we're seeing a particular change in lesions and things like that. And what does that mean about this overall disease process? I think the other thing, just by the nature of where we are and the number of equine submissions that we get, since we're kind of a central area. So if you think one farm is having an issue, maybe another farm is having an issue, but if they're both submitting to us, then sometimes we can be kind of the first people to be like, you know, we're seeing an uptick in this, you know, nicardiform placentitis or something like that, and get that information out to the practitioners to be like, you know, we need to keep a pulse on this. So just because of our location and that we receive submissions from so many practitioners and farms in the area, if there is kind of a more general issue that may be going on, you know, we are in the place and potential to be the first ones to see it. And then, you know, to be like, okay, guys, we might be having an issue, you know, let's talk, you know, is this something that's occurring? Or if we all talk and we can reel it out to something else, be like, nope, it's fine. And so, so I think that's something that's unique and good about our particular area and how we can contribute to overall equine health for sure.
Thank you very much, Dr. James, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
Thank you, Stephanie. It was really great to be here with you guys. I really enjoyed it. And thank you to all the listeners as well.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for joining us. I also want to thank our sponsor, Zoetis. For more from The Horse, visit thehorse.com, sign up for our newsletters, or look for Ask The Horse Live wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Please join us next time as we explore the horse industry equine innovators.